lot has happened since writer E. Patrick Johnson first came on the podcast a decade ago to talk about his groundbreaking book, Sweet Tea, a collection of more than 60 life stories of gay black men who were born, raised, and continue to live in the South.
Johnson's book won various literary awards, got turned into a solo stage show which he performed, and now it's taken up a new life as a documentary film, Making Sweet Tea, which shows some of the book's subjects as they brew up a fresh pot of sweet tea and chat about their lives.
Today, Dr. E. Patrick Johnson joins us to talk about his new documentary film, Making Sweet Tea, which is currently making the rounds at film festivals.
Listen as E. Patrick shares with us stories of resiliency among queer men of color in the South. And he kicks off the podcast with an excerpt of Mean Little Sissy, the true story of artist Freddie Stiles, who sliced a bully with a razor blade when he was just a kid.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Unlock a delicious world of podcasting magic and listen to thousands of amazing shows at feastoffun.com/plus.
In sixth grade, some boys would bother me and the teacher kept it after school. And I would always say in the sweetest little voice, because you see, I'm reasonably soft-spoken now, "Leave me alone. I'm minding my business. Don't bother me." And this boy ran up to hit me and I cut him across the shoulder with my razor blade. By that time, the teacher came back. She said, "You boys better go home." The last thing I heard him say was, "You're a mean little sissy. I'm going to have your ass locked up." I went home. I didn't say anything to my mother. And bravely the next day, I went to school. And the same boy came up to me and he had a hairline cut across his shoulder because I had cut through two or three layers of clothing. He said, "You better be glad." I said, "Listen, do not bother. I want to be left alone. I keep telling you to leave me alone. I'm not bothering you. Don't bother me." And what always happened, if anyone attacked me, they always ended up seeing some of their own blood because I would hit them with a sharp object. So rumor spread. Don't bother him. He's a mean little sissy. And he's stronger than he looks.
That is E. Patrick Johnson, Elondist Patrick Johnson from Hickory, North Carolina.
Hickory!
And see, baby, he is on today's Feast of Fun talking about Making Sweet Tea, the new documentary film that chronicles the deep personal lives of black men in the South that is based on your book that became a play, a one-man show, and now is a documentary film. Welcome back to Feast of Fun a decade later.
I know. It's so fun and fabulous to be back here with you, Bo.
Glad to have you here, Doctor.
Dr. Patrick Johnson. Mm-hmm. When we found out through the documentary that your first, the E stands for Elondist.
Elondist, yes. And for, you know, a long time, I didn't know where that name came from. And I asked my mom and she said, "Oh, I found it in some book." Well, here's the tea.
Oh.
Oh, I got it. We're drinking, by the way. We're drinking some sweet tea right now, if you can hear it. And it, how many sugar cups of sugar is in this?
We just did one.
It was the compromise. The compromise. A pitcher usually has two cups.
Yes.
And I feel like the first time you came over, we did that, and it instantly rotted my teeth.
One is enough.
One is enough. Yes,
yes. For us grown girls.
So the T stands for truth.
For truth. So my name, Elondist, I found out is after my father's brother.
Oh, okay.
But I found this out after my mother passed away and when I was going through some of her things. And she kept a little box for all of her kids. And we didn't know any of this, but we discovered this. And in my box, I had all this stuff, including those little cards. You know, when you're born, the little cards says, you know, you weigh 7 pounds, 8 ounces, whatever. And it had Elondist after my uncle Elondist. I was like, "Oh, I didn't know this story." So I don't know if my uncle, my real daddy, or what. But that's where my name came from.
Because in the documentary, we see this wonderful scene between your mother talking about her ex-husbands. I don't want to talk bad about them, so I'm not going to say anything. But
yes,
she calls one
a whore
and the other
a drunk. But I can't talk about it.
Was that surprising for you when she revealed that on camera during the making of the documentary film?
I tell people all the time that my school of shadeology was my home because my mother could throw shade like nobody else. You know, yeah. One of her favorite sayings for people who were fat was, "Oh, she's successful." So, you know, anyway, so it doesn't surprise me that she was being coy talking about her husband's. But, you know, she's not trying to be funny. And that's what makes it funny, yeah. You know, because she was serious. She said, you know, you're recording this and I can't say it, but, you know,
I won't say it. I can't say it. But I will tell you, he was a whore. And the funny thing is because you could tell the way the camera was just kind of looking on her. I'm like, she's going to say it. She's going to say something, you know.
It surprised me in the moment, though, because I didn't know what she was going to say.
It's so wonderful that you got all these people to open up initially for your book, and you transformed the transcripts of those interviews into a one-man show, and then decided to bring a filmmaking crew back to their homes all over the South to capture them, a lot of them, just months before they passed away.
Yeah, and the most harrowing of those was Harold. You know, Harold and Harold, Harold Mays and Harold Herman. We had actually flown to Washington, D.C. About 2 weeks before Harold passed away. We didn't know that he was ill. We had gone there to make tea because he was the only one on camera that we didn't have making tea. So we had gone there to film him, and we were going to stay with him. And when we got there, the day before, he wasn't answering his phone, and I got concerned, and so I went to the house. He didn't come to the door, and I did a wellness check, and the police said he's in the hospital. So Stephen and I went to visit him in the hospital, and he was kind of out of it. He had had an infection. It became septic, and he was kind of hallucinating, and it was just like, ugh, it was really harrowing because his husband, Harold, had passed away exactly a year before. Mm. And 2 weeks later, he passed away. So we were really fortunate to get a lot of these folks on camera before, you know, they passed on. And now they live on through the film and through their interviews and sweet tea, but you know, it's really hard, you know, watching folks, even my mom, you know, passed away just 2 months before the film came out. So there's a long in memoriam section in the film.
Was your mom able to see some of the film before it was finished?
Unfortunately, no, because when we filmed her making tea and those interactions, she was in a really good place, but she had onset dementia. Mm. But by the time we were in, you know, post-production, you know, her dementia was so bad that she wouldn't have known what was going on. So, no, she never got to see any of the clips from the film.
I'm sorry to hear that.
That must be extremely bittersweet. The Countess Vivian.
No pun intended.
Well, yeah. To the T. Well, and you have such a, you know, sunny, cheerful, optimistic viewpoint on people who struggled and suffered so much throughout their lives, being marginalized in one way or another. And I think that's really, to me, what makes your documentary Making Sweet Tea so touching is how beautiful and wonderful these people's lives are despite all the obstacles they faced.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also something that the book brings out, too. There's a lot of resilience despite some really, really hard times. And, you know, one of my motivations for doing the book was so we have some kind of archive because these stories weren't, you know, documented in any real way. And then, you know, I realized that the book couldn't capture the kind of colorful characters that I would meet, like Freddie, you know, mm-hmm. the mean little sissy. But even the performance doesn't capture the men's lives in their own voice and word and image in a way that speaks to their truth in a kind of holistic way. And so that's why it was important to try to capture them on film and in their own space. I think it adds yet a different layer to it. And also to have them in their own voice and words talk about what it meant to grow up Black and gay in the South, and particularly in a particular time. Someone like Countess Vivian, you know, born in 1912 and, you know, growing up in New Orleans in the 20s and 30s. What a life. And then all the way to someone like Sean, who's is the youngest in the film, and growing up in North Carolina in the 70s and 80s. So we have, you know, a long swath of time that you see, you know, folks really dealing with what it meant to grow up Black and gay in the South in at different points in time in history. And they're all, you know, some of those stories overlap and some of them are very different, you know, because AIDS is a sort of a key marker between someone like Countess Vivian and the Harolds and Freddie and someone like Duncan and Sean and myself.
Hmm. We've seen so many major shifts since you started this project over a decade ago. We've seen the end of President Obama's tenure as president and the rise of right-wing fascism and in the United States. We've seen the success of Alexander Hamilton, the musical, and an incredible appetite for African-American voices and actors and performances, the rise of Billy Porter and Pose mm-hmm. as a juggernaut of television and Broadway. I mean, Billy Porter is posed to be a EGOT, somebody who's got all the awards from an Emmy to a Tony to an Oscar and a Grammy. We've seen the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement and social media showing us the vicious police murders that African Americans face every day in this country. How has that impacted all your work? Because in the middle of this project, the world dramatically transformed.
Yeah, the world transformed and my life transformed, you know, being a witness to all of it. And in some ways, I'm just happy to still be alive because, you know, people talk about trigger warnings. I'm like, as a Black man in America, I'm triggered every day, you know, just waking up, walking outside my house because you never know if you're going to make it back home. And that is scary. And that's why I think, as you were mentioning before, it's so remarkable the resiliency of these men that they press on despite all of the things that are going on in the world today, in this moment, and that have transpired since the book came out in 08. Because even though the book came out in 08, I conducted these interviews in 2004, between 2004 and 2006. So, you know, Baby Bush was in office when I was collecting these interviews. And then a lot happened after that. But I think one of the things that people don't realize, because we're in such a, I guess, two steps forward moment in a way, that despite all the progress we've made with, you know, having a Black president, having marriage equality and all of that, that people are still suffering from internalized homophobia. People are still feeling threatened just for being who they are. Black trans women are being murdered at an alarming rate. Don't live. The average age is 35. So there are all of these things that are still happening. And yet, despite all of that, we're still here. And so the film, in some ways, is, it, you know, making sweet tea is the obvious metaphor, but it's also making a life despite the odds stacked against us. And I think one of the things I hope that the film does is, especially for younger folks, A, you know, sort of give them a glimpse into a part of history that they, you know, may not know about or may not recognize, but also let them know that, you know, honey, it ain't just all about, you know, rainbows and flags and glitter. You know, people that have gone through some shit for you to be out there on the street waving your flag.
Well, that's why the artist Freddie Stiles, the mean little sissy, who cut his schoolmate with a razor blade. In the documentary, it's revealed they later had a romantic affair with the boy.
Yes,
he defended himself on.
Freddie says they had a tryst.
What kind of tryst?
He loves using that word. We had a tryst later on. Yeah, I mean, Freddie, you know, is basically talking about how someone, and this, and, you know, that would have been, Freddie was born in 44, so this would have been, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s, and, you know, I couldn't imagine being a homosexual during that time, let alone being black and a homosexual in the South during that time. But I think what he speaks to is, you know, folks who aren't comfortable being who they are and being self-possessed. One of the ways in which they deal with that is through violence, or, you know, projecting their own self-hatred onto others, because that's the only way they know how to deal, you know, with their own sexuality. And so Freddie actually says this in the film. He says, you know, he realizes now that was the way of a lot of bullies, homophobic bullies, that it was their way of actually getting close to the one that they were trying to disavow. You know, it's the thing that you want, but you can't acknowledge that you want it, so you act out against it. And that's very different, I think, than, you know, what some of these really homophobic people use as a defense when they murder someone. They, you know, homosexual panic. You know, when they, you know, take a someone home and then they kill them. That's very different, I think, than, you know, kids who are like trying to figure out what this is they're feeling. And, you know, their one way of dealing with that is, you know, violence. But Freddie had a remedy for that. He pulled out his blade.
And now he makes amazing art. He's kind of like a very Jackson Pollock inspired artist with just this wonderful texture on a canvas that's done by using a pine needle to paint with.
Yes. You know, he would the mural that we work on in the film is one that he started with pine. Like, who paints with pine needles?
Well, in Freddie Georgia, does. There are a lot of pine needles down there, right?
Yes.
Well, that's the interesting thing about this. In watching Making Sweet Tea is how deeply impactful it was to be validated. We've always said, like, you know, the great thing that you can do as a journalist, as an artist, or as an entertainer is to help lift the voices of people who don't necessarily be seen or heard. And, you know, it was really wonderful, very touching moments in the show where these individuals suddenly dawned on them and then on you that their stories will live on past all our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think any of us realized when we were filming that we were really documenting this sort of longevity of Black queer life in the South, because, you know, hopefully the film will be around after we're long gone, but it will have, you know, a lasting impression. Because one of the things for me watching the film is, although, you know, I only had basically two major interactions with someone like Countess Vivian, his story is just such an amazing story. Someone of that age who survived Katrina, who...
He stayed in his house.
Didn't leave his house.
And was in his 90s at that point in time.
Yeah, he was 93 when Katrina hit in 2005, and he didn't leave his house. And he talks about watching people float down the street on mattresses and tires, and he was just, you know, sitting by the window watching them.
Was he like elevated or something above it all, or, you know, because I know, like, Chubby Checker, he was in Katrina and he had to get up on his roof.
Well, because of where Countess lived, which was the Treme area, the flooding wasn't as bad, but his house was set off the ground 7 feet, which was just enough for the water not to come in. But again, if he's watching people float down the street, the water's pretty high.
I'd be nervous.
And he said,
but imagine all the other things he's lived through, right?
Exactly. Like I said, you know, and you were here a month without electricity. He said, well, honey, I wasn't born with electricity. I'm like, duh.
Well, that's like my dad. He used to store jars compulsively of water all over the place, like a squirrel stores nuts. Mm-hmm. I'm imagining that the Countess Vivian did the same thing.
Yeah, because, you know, he lived, you know, he lived through the Depression. Yeah. So you can imagine the kind of survival strategies that, you know, he and his family devised just to survive. And so he was nonplussed by the whole thing and lived to tell it.
And he, you know, he served in World War II. That's correct, right? And you show a picture of him coming out of the army.
He was
and
I was so like, cute.
Oh my God, what a fox. Mm-hmm. What did he have to say about New Orleans? Because he lived in New Orleans after the war in the 40s and 50s. I could just, you know, this is Streetcar Named Desire era. I can imagine what it was like.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he talks about this in the book about these trans sex workers who would rent these shotgun houses in the French Quarter and lure their trade in there and pickpocket them. So while one was having sex, you know, with the patron, the other one would go in their pocket and, you know, steal their money.
Rolling.
Yeah. Yes. And he said, you know, they didn't have anything in these shotgun houses because if it got, you know, if they went to go get the police, you know, they'd have to move very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so there was this wonderful, vibrant, queer community there that he was a part of. And, you know, he said he was named or he was ordained a countess by a black Russian drag queen named Olga.
So she speak like this, you are now Countess Vivian.
Exactly. So it's hilarious. But he, you know, he said that, you know, all of them were given names.
Mm. It was like your coming out party, your debutante.
Duncan wanted to be rich and famous before he came out. Duncan was pulled out of the closet by his parents.
Yeah, a family friend had a son who was gay bashed, and it was sort of like a wake up call for his parents. And they tell him, you know, you better watch your son because what happened to our son might happen to yours. And so it's kind of, his mother says, are you practicing homosexuality?
I'm an expert.
No, Mom, I'm really good at it.
Duncan sort of is like pulled out of the closet and made to reveal, you know, his sexuality. And he, you know, talks about things that were thought as cute and funny as a kid, all of a sudden was not, you know, because, you know, he was effeminate and that was thought as cute. And I can relate to that because, you know, my mother used to dress me in wigs. I have all these pictures of when I was a kid and my mother had me, you know, in these big wigs. I was like 3 or 4.
And now you're bald.
I know. And now I'm bald. I could use
We get to see
wigs.
You in, with hair.
I know.
Looking so butch.
I have facial hair. And yeah, it's my butch side.
Well, we sort of get a sense of what your life was like before you came out to your family and your friends. And to me, I've always known you as this, like, you know, queer icon, this storyteller, this academic who wants to lift these marginalized voices and, you know, present them to the whole world to learn and love. And it's funny to see you, your past, where that wasn't who you were.
No, I was very closeted. Although, you know, friends say, well, if you didn't want anybody to know, you should have took the sign down. Because, you know, I was very effeminate and, you know, always had a very soft voice and sang soprano in the church choir. Was the only boy over there singing soprano and could out-sing all those girls. But there was a part of me that always felt like if I came out, if I acknowledged that, then somehow my star wouldn't shine as bright. And so all of this comes to a head when, you know, I earn a PhD and the community wants to celebrate me because
you're the first Black person from your community to get a PhD.
Yeah. So they
did a E. Patrick Johnson Day.
Yeah. So they have Dr. E. Patrick Johnson Day. It's July 20th, 1996. And it was a big deal. You know, the mayor was there and I didn't get a key to the city. I got a hickory stick, you know, because Hickory's known for furniture. And so yeah. They gave me a hickory stick.
Because you're from Hickory, North Carolina.
I'm from Hickory.
Hickory. it's a very good wood.
Yes, it is a good wood. Mm-hmm. And so all these folks were there. My first grade teacher was there and she presented me with this, my first research report on pigs that she had been keeping for.
I wonder what if you were to research pigs now, what that would look like.
oink, oink. So it was a big deal, but, you know, I was not out, and there was no way that I was going to acknowledge my sexuality. And looking back on that day, now, you know, it's been over 20 years, it's like, if I had been out, I don't know that they would have celebrated me. Mm. And so the film is partially about me going back home to reckon with my past. Mm-hmm. And now as a openly gay man and, you know, what that all means, because it, you know, for a long, long time, I was not open.
You talk a bit in the documentary about, you know, this desire to achieve, to accomplish things, to get respect, to kind of moderate that blow for that day when you do come out.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm wondering now that there's more acceptance and stuff for gay people or for queer people that maybe we're going to become slackers because we don't necessarily feel the need to achieve as much in order to make that blow not seem so intense.
Yeah, I think it varies from person to person and, you know, from region to region because, you know, even though a place like the South has progressed along with everybody else, there's still places where that is, it's not as progressive, it's not mm-hmm. as easy. But I think everybody's journey is different. You know, mine was so much about the church and being steeped in a very religious context. And I mean, the irony about that is I felt the gayest in church because my pastor wasn't homophobic. Actually, there was never any, I never remember a sermon about homosexuality or being damned to hell. And, you know, singing in the choir, I felt free. I had my robe, which was like a dress. You know, I could twirl and work my robe. And I got all this encouragement from church people. So it's kind of ironic that the same thing that I feel sort of helped me be free, and at least in terms of my gender expression, was also the thing that I was most fearful about in terms of being open about my sexuality. Because despite there not being any rhetoric from the pulpit about homosexuality, you still knew that was not right. Mm. And so I did a lot of hiding from that, even from myself.
For Black men who grew up in the pre-Stonewall era, how did they find each other, like, for romance and sex? In New York City, for example, a lot of white gay men would go hang out in the lobby at Judy Garland's shows and be like, are you a friend of Dorothy's? Mm-hmm. And for that generation in North Carolina or other places, in doing this research, did you get any insights into any kind of specific events that, you know, queer men of color sought out?
The cruising spots.
Yeah. Well, house parties. Those were really, really big. One of the people that I interviewed for Sweet Tea, Jeff Smith, who was 86 at the time I interviewed him, The community had just celebrated the 50th anniversary of his house parties. They were legendary. People would come. He lived in Durham, North Carolina, and people would come from Virginia, Atlanta, all around to his house parties.
How big is this house?
It was a big house back then.
So how many people could it hold?
Probably over 100.
Oh, wow. So yeah. it was a humdinger.
Yeah. And he would sit at the door, and in order to get entrance into the house, you'd have to kiss him.
On the lips.
I don't know. I didn't ask what they were kissing, but you had to kiss him. And he had a DJ, and he would sell food and liquor.
What year are we talking here?
Well, they started in 1948 after he got out of the war.
So the DJ is playing like the finals.
Well, yeah. Back then, I don't know. And then, but they
to graph.
But they went on for 50 years.
Amazing.
And so that was one of the big places, house parties. And then, you know, in the South, there are a lot of these juke joints that are kind of literally hole in the walls where people would gather and hang out. And then other times, places like everywhere else, you know, the rest stops and other kind of tea room trade places.
There's something that's lost in the modern day now, especially for marginalized people, because of these dating apps, these hookup apps and social media. There's not a lot of the development of social structures. In fact,
or social skills.
Or social skills. Yeah. And you know, like, and just talking to our listeners, some of them go like, why am I always finding love, you know, 3,000 miles away? Mm-hmm. And I respond to them, because they're so far out of your reach. That's why you want them the most.
Yeah. Because, you know, when you lived in communities where you were, you know, looking for like-minded folks, you knew that they were close. And so you found a way to find them. And one of those ways was actually through the church. You know, there's so much that goes on in the church. Mm. I mean, it's such a bundle of contradictions there. But, you know, and we communicate so much through looks. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you give you a little look and you know, you start talking. Then you just slip someone a piece of paper with an address on it where the party's going to be. And so with the apps, you know, you could be somebody, you know, in Australia, not around the corner from you that you can, and you can have, you know, cyber sex or whatever, but it's still not the same as being touched by someone else. And I think that one of the things that these communities had was proximity to one another, and they could be intimate in a real, you know, genuine way. Even if it was just a hookup, there's nothing like, you know, being touched by someone. Oh, it's making me moist just talking about it. There's nothing like being touched by someone else.
Well, so a friend of mine said, it's like, yeah, you can see them on the internet and you can respond to a photo, but you don't know what their voice sounds like. Yeah. You don't know what their smell.
Yeah.
And smell is a very subtle thing.
Yeah.
We don't even aware of how we're influenced by smells. And Mark's really good at that.
I am.
Yeah, like just preparing our home studio for Patrick, you were like ionizing the air, boiling.
Well, I never know what the dog's going to smell like sometimes, you know what I mean? So you just have to make sure that the air is fresh.
But I think,
and I like clean air. We live in the city, it's dirty air, so I'm always trying to filter the air so it's clean.
But smells like impact how you subconsciously deal with things.
You go into a hookup to house and it's like their house smells like a kitty litter. You're just like, oh.
I'm done with that. Yeah.
And you know, if you're going to take that nesty dive, you don't want, you know, that smell coming up from down there.
Some people like the raunch.
Well, there's a difference between, you know, musk. Shit and musk. You know, a little BO or funk, but, you know, you don't want.
What I thought was interesting too in your documentary is you perform, because your stage show, making, you know, Sweet Tea, you're performing in the character of these people who you've documented. And you've gone in front of them, and you are performing them in front of them.
Yeah.
What's that like?
It's nerve-wracking because you know, it's
it's somebody's story, and you're performing them, you know, in their house or at their church or on their job. And, you know, I can't imagine what it's like watching somebody perform you.
Impersonate
you. Yeah. And what's that was sort of the experimental part of the film that the director wanted to capture. This was his idea. John Jackson, who is a anthropologist at Penn and ethnographic filmmaker, he was really invested in having some experimental part be in the film. And that was his idea, to have me performing them in their own space. And it was daunting. Mm. But I think what's so beautiful about the film is you as the audience member are watching them watching me. Mm-hmm. And it's such an interesting moment.
Did any of the people say, like, I don't sound that sissy?
No, I mean, you know, Duncan critiques me because he says, well, you know, your voice isn't as low as mine. And he's right. You know? I'm not a true baritone. I'm more of a tenor.
But as you get older, the voice does drop.
Yes, it does.
Lauren Bacall effect.
Yes, and Duncan really does drop. But Freddie, for instance, says that I perform his story better than he does. So, no, they were all, you know, happy with my performance of them.
There is an Eartha Kitt quality to what you bring to Freddie Stiles' mean little sissy passage. You know, like, it's hard not to have that pronunciation voice that Eartha had. And that's a reality for a lot of people of color in that region, especially if they were marginalized or worked in the arts, is that there was a conscious effort to train your voice to be clearer so you could access different spaces, white spaces.
Yeah, I mean, you know, linguists call it code switching. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you had one way of speaking around your folk and another around white folk. And it was, again, another mode of survival. And Freddie's from Madison, Georgia, which is, you know, the legend is it's the one town that Sherman didn't burn. So there were all these beautiful homes still left in Madison, Georgia after the Civil War. But he has a very particular way of speaking that's very mannered and very Southern. And when he's telling a story like being a mean little sissy, it's very important that you get all of it, because he goes into the voice not only of his teacher, but also that little boy who tried to mess with him. And so it's funny to me, every time I do that story, I almost start laughing because it's hilarious, because I can just see Freddie, because he's a small man. And, you know, he says in the narrative that he would carry the single edge razor blade to sharpen his pencil. Now, and he's saying that with a side eye, like, yeah.
In case he gets stopped and asked, why do you have that? Oh, right. To sharpen my pencils. Which I will jab into your eye if you ask me again.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, he devised a strategy to protect himself. Mm-hmm. And so he loves telling stories, and he loves having a space to share his story in particular. He could talk for hours about all of his different dalliances or trysts, because it was important to him, and it is important to him to not be seen as a victim. He talks about that a lot. That despite surviving molestation, surviving a mother and grandmother who didn't want him, despite losing his partner of 44 years, he's still resilient.
I love that Freddie said that therapy allowed him to listen to his stories and laugh.
Yeah, yeah. That, you know, there was something about being able to tell the story that helped him work through the pain of it. And so now he can look back at it and laugh. But it wasn't a laughing matter while he was experiencing it.
Making Sweet Tea is now out in film festivals, making the and it's getting standing applause, ovations. Yeah, at the
and
end
we've
of the
won
show.
two awards. Yeah, at the Reeling Festival, we were surprised that we were
That's Chicago Gay and Lesbian Film Festival.
40 years in the running now.
Yeah, we were at the during the Q&A, and then the moderator all of a sudden stops abruptly and says, you know, I need to cut this short because I want to bring the festival director down to make a special announcement. And so the festival director comes down and says, you know, we partner with a lot of organizations for our film awards, and I'm happy to announce that Making Sweet Tea has been awarded the Silver Image Award by the AARP.
That's fantastic.
That's a good award to get.
Yes. Yeah. And so then he asks the president of the AARP to come down and present the award to us. And we were like so shocked. Mm-hmm. So the Silver Image Award is given to the film with the most positive representation of LGBTQ folks over 50. And it's a beautiful award. It was this beautiful crystal obelisk. And we were totally surprised by it. And then at Atlanta, we won the Audience Award for Best Documentary.
Wow, congratulations.
So two festivals, two awards. I think we're on a roll. Mm-hmm.
This is like, you know, with the success of Moonlight. I'm just keep thinking about like moments in culture that there's a lot of public appetite to see and hear Black voices more than ever, I think, in history. And despite all the horrors that we see in this world, that's something really inspiring to know that there's more opportunities now than ever to showcase your work. Considering the success that you've had with Making Sweet Tea, obviously you're working on a new project that explores this topic further.
Well, you know, I'm sort of not.
I'm moving on to something new.
I've been Sweet Tea is like the gift that keeps on giving and, you know, turns from being a book and a stage reading, then a stage play, and now a film. And, you know, now my book, Black Queer Southern Women, came out last year. And then just last week, my book, Honey Pot, came out, which is the story of Black lesbians of the South. So I'm sort of like just riding the wave of this work rather than diving into the next thing.
Is it easier to find people to talk to now that you sort of have such a reputation for telling these stories? Or this is something that happens with us, is that because we're so visible, sometimes people are a little bit have more trepidation. Mm-hmm. And you have to sell them harder the idea of telling their story. For a lot of these men in 2004, they were like, oh, isn't he sweet? This academic, you know, wanted to tell my story, not realizing that their lives would be immortalized in this book and film and show.
Yeah. Well, for Black Queer Southern Women and Honey Pot, those women were actually chomping at the bit to tell their stories. And many of them, you know, knew about Sweet Tea and had seen a play. In fact, that was one of the things that encouraged me to do that book, is because I'd be performing or doing a reading somewhere and someone would, when are you going to write Pink Lemonade? Mm-hmm. which is a title I consider.
Lemonade meaning the lesbian stories.
Yeah, their stories.
That would be Lavender Lemonade.
Well, I'm not even going to go there. So I thought, though, after Sweet Tea came out, that somebody would do the story of Blacklist. But, you know, time went on and no one did it. So I ended up doing it. So I feel that because of Sweet Tea and the success of that book, that they knew that I would take care of their stories and respect them. And so I didn't have any problems finding folks to talk to, finding women to talk to. I have been getting a little bit of pressure to now do trans folks of the South. I don't know. I'm just so tired. and I'm thinking, what would that book be called? You know, I've run through all the kind of sweet metaphors, tea metaphors, and, you know, because sweet tea would have been a great title for a book on trans folks, you know, the tea
for trans.
Right. But that's already taken. So I don't know what that might look like. And, you know, I might do it. I'm not sure. But maybe somebody else.
Well, I remember you saying, because you were people were asking you to do it, and you there was a little hesitancy. You thought maybe it would be better if somebody like a woman did mm-hmm. that story. But nobody came forward. And so you're just kind of like, well, you know, it's their story. I'm just helping facilitate them telling it.
Yeah. And, you know, I talk. In Honeypot, my book that just came out is my first venture into creative nonfiction. Mm. And so it's the same. The stories are real. It's based on the interviews I did with the women. But all the scaffolding around it is fictional. And a lot of it is a metaphor for the tension of what it was like for me being a man collecting these women's stories.
Well, what does that mean, creative nonfiction? Because you have fiction, which are stories that are made up. You've got nonfiction, which is things that are real. But then you have creative nonfiction. So it's like they're real stories, but...
Yeah, but the settings, everything around it is mm-hmm. totally made up. So the conceit of Honeypot is that Miss B, and you don't know whether she's a bee or a real woman. You find out by the end of the book what she is. But she comes to Chicago and she kidnaps Dr. EPJ and takes him to her hive called Hymen and demands that he listen to her sister's stories. And I came up with this because I kept... finding all of these analogies between the life of these women and the life of honeybees. Because they were talking about my honeypot this, my honeypot that. And, you know, I'm a gay man. I didn't know what a honeypot was. Mm-hmm.
Honeypot is slang for trapping someone. Mm. And that, it, at least in most popular culture.
Well.
So, like, for in the film, most recently, the one where they did about the North Korean dictator with Seth Rogen.
Oh.
They used the term honeypot to describe... setting up a delicious, enticing trap in order to capture somebody.
Well, I could see how that could work too, but right? They're talking about vaginas. And which, you know, yeah. is apropos, you know, trapping somebody in something that's delicious and hot.
Sticky, and you sticky can't escape.
And you can't escape. So, you know, a lot of women just kept talking about my honeypot, so I started doing research on honey and then honeybees, and then I found all of these analogies, you know, mm-hmm. like honeybees, the hive is 90%. Female. And the drones, which the male bees, their only purpose is to impregnate a queen bee from another hive. And after they inseminate the queen bee, they're kicked out of the hive.
They have no use for them.
No use for them. And so I came up with this idea of Miss B and Dr. EPJ. And oh my gosh, she's such a hoot. I had so much fun writing it.
Well, I'm looking forward to all this stuff. Making Sweet Tea. People can find out if it's showing in their local area by going to our website.
Yes, makingsweettea.com.
That's amazing. You got that domain.
I know, right?
LinkedIn didn't own it.
We got it. We got it. So makingsweet.com. We have all of our information. You can see stills from the film, and you can read about what's happening with it, about our AARP award, and all things sweet tea. You can find out at makingsweettea.com. Our hope, you know, it's we'll find out in about 6 weeks if we get into Sundance, which is, you know, it's a long shot, but you know, we'll see.
It could happen.
It could happen.
There's an appetite for this kind of
you know,
content.
There's. The film is getting a lot of buzz, and you know, all of these festivals, there's political, you know. Mm-hmm. So hopefully
you gotta pay money to get into some of that. Right. It's just like, oh
yeah. So hopefully, you know, it'll buzz to somebody at Sundance. But if not, you know, we're gonna be hopefully at a lot of festivals in the spring. And that's the other thing about festivals. You submit to them, they don't let you know whether you get in until a month before the festival. So we're just kind of like hanging out like,
Where am I going to next?
Exactly. And of course, some of them we can't make it to, but
And can people buy the film on iTunes at all? Or
Not yet. Okay. Not yet. It'll probably be this time next year before it's available to the wider public.
Well, come on back and we'll fill back. Us up in some more sweet tea.
Yes, it was so much fun being back.
Remember, folks, Feast of Fun is made possible because of your generous contribution. Fierce, fabulous people like you make this podcast possible. Access thousands of legendary shows at feastoffun.com/plus, where you can rest assured that you are making sure Feast of Fun is available for generations to come.
You can also support us at Patreon at patreon.com/feastoffun. You can get a sneak peek at behind the scenes look at Feast of Fun and see episodes of Cooking with Drag Queens before anybody else does.
Cooking with Drag Queens, the original, darling. Accept no substitutions.
And you can also visit our store at feastoffun.com/store and get yourself a not shaven, gives me more time for a misbehaving t-shirt.
When we first started doing this, we were just, you know, like, we were feeding and serving drinks to a lot of our guests as they came in, you know, Feast of Fun. Mm. And we just decided to start filming them, and we did a video with Larry LaFontaine, Lola von Miramar. That was her first time in drag when we made Tostones. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of ways, like, you know, Larry LaFontaine introduced us to you. Mm-hmm. And he kind of occupies a very similar space in lifting the voices of these marginalized Latinx performance artists. And it's been a wonderful ride for us just to be able to sort of combine food and the lives of these gender nonconforming artists, many who, at least half of them, have gone on to become very well-known entertainers. Mm-hmm. As a consequence of that, so many other people have decided, you know what? I want to tell my story about food. With Feast of Fun, with making sweet tea, with cooking with drag queens, a lot of these projects hopefully will inspire you out there to organize your friends and make your own videos, make your own podcasts, and tell your own books and plays and films, and tell your stories. Because ultimately, we want to inspire people to listen to each other. And too much of social media these days is all people like customer service for LGBTQ culture. I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't get to control that. I agree that this is a frustrating situation. Let's work on solutions together. And the best place to start is to start listening.
Yes. Absolutely. And so much happens around food, you know? So much good stuff happens around food.
Girl, we got to get together and cook.
This right here.
I know, I know. I tell people, I don't have a six pack, but I do have an ab. One.
Listen, you're holding pretty good for a man who's 29 years old.
Yeah, thank you.
What is the, like, your go-to decadent food for you?
Chocolate all the time.
So you're a dessert man.
Oh yeah.
And your husband, he's a connoisseur, not a connoisseur of chocolate, but like, he's into pastries.
Yes, he loves my buns. Stephen loves dessert. His thing is ice cream. Okay. He loves ice cream, but mine is chocolate. I could eat chocolate.
Well, like, what's day, like floating day. Your boat these days?
Dark chocolate, milk chocolate,
like a specific no milk dessert
chocolate or dark chocolate.
Have you had the ruby chocolate yet?
Ruby
chocolate. Yeah, there's a fourth kind of, you know, there's white chocolate, milk chocolate, dark chocolate, and they developed a ruby chocolate. So it's made from cocoa beans. It's just and they process it, and so it has more of a fruity kind of taste.
Oh.
But it has the consistency of chocolate.
Oh,
but
no,
it's made from cocoa beans.
I didn't know about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's hard
it
to get.
It feels more like white chocolate. I've had it. It feels more like white chocolate with some mysterious berry flavor that you can't put your finger
I probably
on.
Wouldn't like it because I love the bitterness of dark chocolate. And I don't drink coffee, but I love like chocolate covered
mocha.
Yeah, I like chocolate covered coffee beans.
Oh, yeah. Those are fantastic.
Those will get you really jacked up. I didn't realize it. I was like, why am I so wired? I'm like, it might have been those three espresso beans.
Yeah, because I don't drink coffee. So I was like, ooh. But I love
well,
that.
I'm pretty jacked up with this sweet tea you made. Oh, my goodness.
And it's so beautiful. You that amber color. It's really beautiful.
It's where the truth lives.
It is where the truth lives.
And now the word tea has become slang for you know, telling the truth or gossiping.
Well, it always has.
It has been. It's just become more popular, I think. You know, like shade. Everybody's saying shade. I even heard shade on CNN. I was like, What?
Straight people you shade.
Oh, all the time.
You know?
All the time. All the time. Yeah.
What words will get appropriate in the future? Crunk? That you one know, didn't catch on.
I haven't heard anybody say, you know, tossing my salad or anything like that.
They tried for a bit.
Really?
RuPaul was pushing that one a lot.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. I was like, I'm just tossing some salad.
I think most straight people know the tossing the salad.
They
not
do.
Like, maybe like not your mom or something, but.
It's a, and for people who don't know, tossing your salad is a euphemism for.
Analingus.
Oh, I thought it was a blowjob.
No.
So even I don't know.
It's analingus.
It's snacking in the back door.
It's not too often you get to say that word.
Well, the tea is messy, but you somehow managed to turn it into an art form. And you're also working full time as a college professor.
Yeah, I'm doing the most.
How do you manage your time?
It's hard. It's really difficult because not only that, for 3 years, I was also chair of African American Studies. And before that, for 5 years, I was chair of performance studies. So being an administrator, being a professor, you know, writing books, performing, doing all this stuff, it's a lot.
Is there any temptation to bring some of the knowledge or field from one area of your life into the other? Like in terms of your extensive knowledge of performance studies into the telling of queer Black men's voices?
And- yeah, I mean, that motivates everything I do. That's why, you know, I created a play based on this research. And that's why we did a film, is to actually broaden how research is presented. That people who may not read the book might see the film, but that film came out of research. So it's about opening up a space for other forms of academic work that is not just a book with $3 words in it, but through art. Art is research. It's actually a lot of work goes into it. It's an intellectual engagement as well as an artistic enterprise. And so that motivates all the creative stuff that I do, is, you know, finding ways to do research, but in a way that's going to keep it interesting. You know,
art is research.
It is.
And we thank you so much for helping us research into your life and into the lives of these extraordinary gay Black men of color. Well, they're the Black and of color.
Yeah.
these wonderful men who really survived despite all the obstacles they faced. And we can learn about them and inoculate ourselves into the future against any obstacles that we may face.
Absolutely. And I feel so fortunate to have been given this platform to call attention to these men's lives.
Honey, I am stronger because of people like you.
I tell you,
we have a lot of people like tell us, is like, why are you guys so wise? I'm like, because we have amazing guests like Alondis Patrick Johnson. Dr. Johnson, honey, at your service.
Thank you for coming back on the podcast. And I wish you the best of luck with the documentary. And I hope it wins more awards.
Me too. Thanks.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.